Hello and bon appetit. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Julie Haynes reading to you today from Bon Appetit and Food and Wine magazines with a surprise now and then from other sources. Settle in for a half hour of fine dining with us. Today's first article is Shake, Shake, Shake by Joshua Bossi, Christoph Zuska, and Jordan Mackey with William Elliott, a professional guide to cocktail shakers from the April issue of Food and Wine magazine. The cocktail shaker is the animating force of the bar. It creates the action, noise, motion, and energy that ultimately become the concoctions that drinkers have the pleasure to imbibe. The modern approach to shaking was developed in the 19th century in America when it was found that if two vessels had mouths of different sizes, the smaller rim could fit inside the larger to create a seal, and a drink could be mixed much more vigorously to create new textures and appearances. The first patent for a cocktail shaker, a design by inventor William Harnett, was approved in 1872, thus officially inscribing an object of eternal bartending fascination into the public world. How to shake. The purpose of shaking a cocktail is fourfold: to chill, dilute, mix, and aerate the contents of the shaker. Here are three shaking techniques to know. The tin-on-tin shake. This shake employs a Boston-style shaker and is great for messy scenarios. Big batch drinks with egg whites, like gin fizzes, drinks containing fruit, or anything with mint or cucumber, like mojitos, that would clog a cobbler shaker. It's also the technique to use when shaking large volumes of liquid. Add ingredients to the larger shaker tin, which serves as the base, and fill with ice. Place the top shaker inside the base. Secure the Boston tins by slightly twisting them together while pulling toward your body, then, with the bottom of your palm, gently tap a few times to seal. This shake is done over the shoulder on a vertical path. Start with the small end of the tin held in the palm of your dominant hand, with your other hand holding the bottom end of the shaker. Bring the shaker up near the shoulder, then forcefully push it down to the front of the abdomen. Pull it back and repeat until the liquid within is well chilled. The short shake. Short describes the distance between the shaker travels, not its duration. The technique also uses a Boston shaker and is typically used for dry shakes, shakes done without ice to aerate egg whites, like for a whiskey sour, or for drinks calling for crushed ice, like a julep or sling cocktail, since it involves less dilution. Add the ingredients to the larger tin, secure the two tins together, then pick them up with one hand. Place your index finger on the top tin and anchor the heel of your hand against the crease where the two tins meet. This motion is side-armed, taking place just above waist level, with a quick oscillation back and forth, letting the whip of a loose wrist generate the speed. And then there's the hard shake. This shake uses a cobbler shaker to make cocktails that could be served up, like a daiquiri or gimlet. Add liquids to the shaker, then add ice to just shy of the top. Twist on the top half of the shaker and seal with the cap. Putting the cap on last ensures pressure is equalized inside the shaker. Grasp the cap of the shaker with your dominant hand and the bottom of the shaker with your other hand, and pull the dominant hand back into the shoulder as you might do with a shot put. Next, drive it straight away from you in a flinging motion, guided by your non-dominant hand and propelled by your shoulders. When almost at full extension, flick the wrist of the guiding hand and pull the shaker back to your shoulder. Repeat for for 15 seconds. And here are two of Food and Wine faves for the best cocktail shakers by Clarissa Book Zilberman and Lucy Simon. The Boston Shaker. This shaker consists of two tins, or sometimes a large tin and a clear pint glass. The smaller tin fits inside the larger, creating a seal. The Cocktail Kingdom Leopold Weighted Shaking Tin Set stands out among Boston shakers for its stability, sturdiness, and weight. It feels like a more high-end version. It's available for $30 at cocktailkingdom.com. And for the cobbler shaker, the cobbler shakers include a cup for the ingredients, a cover with a built-in strainer, and a cap. Our current favorite on the market is the OXO Steel Single Wall Cocktail Shaker. The cap doubles as a measuring cup, and its silicone gaskets seal tight and keep it from sticking when the metal expands from the cold. It's available for $23 at OXO.com. And that was The Best Cocktail Shakers by Clarissa Book Zilberman and Lucy Simon. Taking from the article Shake, 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 A Professional Guide to Cocktails by Joshua Bossi, Crystal Zika, Jordan Mackey with William Elliott from the April issue of Food and Wine magazine. Also in this issue is The Hidden Beauty of Bulgari by Ray Isle. La Macchiolese Cinzia Merli reveals the secrets of this sea-bounded Tuscan wine region. This area, Bulgari, is special for potatoes, Cinzia Merli is saying as she rolls out a rope of gnocchi dough on a cutting board, dusted with flour. If I ever had to change my life completely, I could grow potatoes. And what's the secret to gnocchi? Good potatoes. Merli is the proprietor of one of Bulgari's benchmark wineries, La Macchiolese. She makes world-class reds and one white from the Tuscan estate's 86 acres of vines, wines that live in the same rarefied atmosphere as the great Super Tuscans that brought the region its fame, Sassicaia and Ornellaia, particularly. But she also makes excellent gnocchi. January through April, you can't make good gnocchi, she says, slicing the dough into small, even pillows. The potatoes lose too much water. The new crop comes in again in May. In her kitchen at the winery, the light slants through the windows and the open door. It's a temperate day with a soft breeze off the coast rustling through the vine leaves outside. Though Merli will claim over and over that she's not a great cook, this is just her nature. She's modest about everything except her wines, those she is justifiably proud of. She says, my mother is a much better cook than I am, and my younger son even says that. I make some ragu. Do you want some? Yes. Okay, how was it? It was good, but Nona does it better. What can you do, her expression says. Both of Merli's sons are now in their early 30s and work for the family company. Elia, the older, oversees the vineyards. His younger brother, Mattia, helps with sales and marketing. The Maggiole has been their life, Elia says. Officially, I started in 2013, but the first time I worked in the vineyard, I was probably 6 years old. I had my small scissors. I harvested two vines, and I said, okay, now I'm tired. But every Saturday, I went in the truck with my father to go sell the wines. Merli and her husband, Eugenio Campolni, founded La Macchiolese together in 1983 against his own parents' wishes. Agriculture was not good at the time, and wine was worse. Merrily says, but he bought this property anyway and took out a 500 million lira mortgage, about $300,000 at the time. It was a big problem. Both of them had grown up in the area. Campomi's family owned a small restaurant, and Merrily's family were farmers. Campoli's instincts about Lamacchioli's potential proved correct. In 1995, that was when everything changed, she says. There was a France versus Italy tasting of the 1992 vintage at Vinitaly, the massive wine trade show that occurs yearly in Verona. Sassicaia, Onelaia, Redigaffi, us against Chateau Pichon-Lalande and the other great Bordeaux properties. And Lamacchioli was second overall. Nobody knew us, and suddenly, everything changed. Overnight, everyone was coming to our booth wanting to taste. The late 1990s were halcyon years for the couple. Then, Campomi was diagnosed with lung cancer, and in July 2002, he died. He was 40. Merrily was 35. Elia and Mattia were 13 and 9. Even then, women rarely, if ever, ran wineries in Italy. Everyone in the region, in the standard chauvinistic way of the times, assumed she would sell. Everyone except Merrily herself. She kept on. I lost my husband in July, and the harvest that year was the worst in 15 or 20 years. Cold and incredibly rainy. Then 2003 was really hot. So hot. And I started to think, this is a sign. I'm being told not to do this. This is not my work, not my destiny. But my brother came to me and said, listen, one more vintage, then you decide. So 2004, I think the moment for me was when we released the 2004 vintage and our wine, Missorio, got 100 points. And probably a lot of people thought, okay, she actually can do this. She smiles. Well, yes. Today, Lamacchioli is internationally recognized as one of Tuscany's greatest estates. It has changed in some ways. The original 10 acres of vineyards have grown to 86 over the years. All are farmed organically. We went organic because Eugenio got sick, Merrily says. I didn't want to expose anyone else at the winery to those risks. But it is still very much a family business and a farm more than anything else. My family are farmers, and I like to think of Lamacchioli that way, Merrily says, not just as a wine producer. Bulgari has changed too. It never fit the classic idea of Tuscany, the hilltop towns, the yellow and orange villas, all that under the Tuscan sun, languors, find your bliss through pasta cliché. Bulgari is on the coast, a subregion of the larger Maremma. Specifically, it's the Maremma Livornese, or Alta Maremma, the lowlands of which were, until the mid-1800s, more or less a malarial swamp. As one old Tuscan folk song has it, everybody tells you about Maremma, Maremma, but it seems to me that Maremma is bitter. The bird that goes there loses its feathers. I lost a loved one there. May Maremma, Maremma be damned. Cheery. But in the 1820s, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Leopoldo II, brought in some 5,000 workers to turn the swamp into fertile land. And that fertile land proved, at least by the 1980s, to be perfect for wine grapes. Not the traditional Sangiovese of Tuscany, but French varieties, which are what, in 1983, Campomi and Merlot planted. Syrah, Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot, among others. In essence, Bulgari is where the hills of Tuscany meet the sea and is a place to visit. It offers the best of both. Fresh fish abounds in its restaurants, but so does the famed Chianina beef of Tuscany's inland regions. You can buy wild boar prosciutto at a salumeria in a tiny town perched above the coast. Speciolati mucci e stagioli in Monteverde Marittimo. Then descend down winding roads and find yourself sipping a spritz at sunset in an outdoor bar with a view of the water, such as Colto e Mangiato, just down the street from La Macchiola. Spend time with Marilee, and inevitably you'll end up at some of her favorite spots, the Piccolo Biscottificio Castagnetano in Castagnato Carducci, where the Biagioni family makes traditional Caroli incest, biscotti with an eagle-shaped outline that references the coat of arms of the noble Giardesca family. Osteria Magnona, where Chef Omar Barashi will cook you a massive bistecca alla Florentina to go with La Macchioli's complex, compelling Palio Rosso Red. Or La Pineta, where you can sit at a table looking over the Tyrrhenian Sea at sunset and know that the fish on your plate came from that water a few hundred feet away. Or you can just spend a day sunning yourself on the beach, not an uncommon pursuit, especially for the residents of Livorno to the north. The Livornese are tan from March to November, Marilee says. They're like lizards on the rocks as soon as the sun comes out. But if you're lucky, you'll just sit down to eat whatever Marilee decides herself to cook. On a recent day, that meant that these gnocchi tossed with asparagus and pancetta, risotto with zucchini and shrimp, and an herb-crusted roast pork loin. We talked about Bulgari, what it was and what it's become. It's more visited than it once was, no question, but it still lacks the hordes who descend on Siena, Arsene, Gimignano, or even more alarmingly, Florence. There's also been a boom in wineries, the number rising from 45 to 70 just since 2019. Tourism really started picking up 10 years ago, Marilee says. I'm convinced it's the richness of our region. Not just the wine. The wine is the money, sure. But we have so many things to offer, and we help each other. And Bulgari, success is a currency shared by everyone. And that was The Hidden Beauty of Bulgari by Ray Isle from the April issue of Food and Wine magazine. Our next article, also from the April issue of Food and Wine magazine, is The Joys of Ginger by Andrea Nguyen. Use ginger generously and it will reward you a thousandfold. At supermarkets, I'm the one leaning deep into the ginger pile, searching for a gnarled, chubby hand or plump knob to add to my purchase. Pity the cook who stingingly buys ginger, I say. It keeps well and has so many uses. You should have lots around, all the time. Ginger might not be as ubiquitous as salt or pepper, but it makes up for that with plenty of personality. To ginger something up is to enliven it. To have ginger is to be spirited, to have extra metal. There are countless ways to use ginger, from savory to sweet, at every part of the meal, from morning till night. Ginger can add spicy or sweet heat, mitigate overly vegetal or fishy flavors, and even help you digest beans. Related to turmeric, galangal, and cardamom, ginger, Zingiber officinal, took root in tropical Asia about 5,000 years ago. From there, it spread throughout East, Southeast, and South Asia. Over time, the rhizomes, it's a tuberous stem, not a root, arrived on other shores via trade routes and colonial conquests. It reached the Mediterranean by the 1st century, and by the 11th century it was popular in England. By the 13th and 14th centuries, it was considered so precious there that a pound of ginger was said to cost the same as an entire sheep. Spanish explorers brought ginger to Mexico, South America, and the Caribbean. It took so well to the latter location that by the early 1700s, Europe was importing most of its ginger from the West Indies. Given that ginger can be propagated only by planting a small section of a fresh rhizome, its international travels prove that it's as hardy as it is beloved. A gorgeous reed-like plant, ginger's flowers, leaves, and tuber stem can all be used in cooking, but we mainly eat the mature, tan-skinned underground portion, which these days, thankfully, is affordable and easy to find. India, Nigeria, and China produce most of the world's ginger. In the United States, ginger mainly grows in Hawaii. Non-volatile compounds, primarily gingerol, zingarone, and chagol, are what give ginger its distinctive bite. Fresh ginger contains all three, but gingerols, which are chemically related to chilies capsicum and black peppers piperine, dominate. Cooking ginger softens and transforms some of those compounds into gingerone, which has a sweeter, milder bite. Fresh ginger is extraordinarily versatile. It expresses itself differently depending on how it is prepared and whether or not it is cooked. Peeled ginger has perky vibrancy, whereas unpeeled ginger retains an earthy bite. Minced or finely chopped ginger disperses gentle heat throughout a dish. A knob of ginger can be thinly sliced on a mandolin and slipped into a bowl dish like salty, sweet, sticky Chinese-style chicken wings. The chunks may look intimidating, but they actually mellow into a friendly treat. On the other hand, grated ginger looks tame, but it offers a concentrated gingery zip. Drying ginger also transforms the gingerols, turning them into chagales, which are twice as pungent. This is why ground ginger is more intense than fresh ginger. I grew up with only fresh ginger because that's what Vietnamese cooks use. Iconic dishes such as pho and bò khô, beef stew, rely on ginger for a pungent undercurrent. But over time, living and cooking globally, like many people do, I've expanded my horizons. Look around my kitchen today, and you'll spot fresh, ground, pickled, and candied ginger. Never fear layering on ginger in several ways in one dish or combining different kinds. For instance, you can use ginger to brine, glaze, and sauce a pork roast, all without the aromatic ingredient overwhelming the dish. Fresh ginger's bite enlivens pickled ginger's sweet tang in a Burmese-inspired salad, and candied ginger lends an edge to lychee sorbet with its spicy, sweet, chewy contrast to the refreshing dessert. The bottom line? Be bold and generous with ginger. It will repay you many times over. A guide to ginger. Fresh, mature ginger is what we most commonly encounter at the supermarket. Its tough, tan skin signals that it's mature with its pep at full throttle. Choose plump, heavy hands with few small fingers to minimize prep. Trim any moldy areas and store unpeeled ginger in a Ziploc plastic bag in the crisper where it will last for months. To easily peel, break off the biggest ginger fingers, then use a swivel peeler or a sharp-edged metal spoon on the main bulbous stem. Use a knife to cut off the skin from smaller pieces. You can also keep a knob or two of peeled ginger in the fridge to save on prep time. Young baby ginger appears at East Asian markets in early spring, April and May, and into early fall, September and October. Compared to mature ginger, young ginger is about 50% milder and less fibrous. Its gossamer skin and pinkish blushing tips do not require peeling. Just rub off any loose skin and prep away. Young ginger is used for pickled ginger. Pickled ginger isn't only for sushi. It can be added to stir fries and salads, for example. Most people gravitate toward Japanese-style gari, which is delicately tangy and mildly hot, perfect for sushi and sometimes sashimi. Deep red julienne benishoga is pickled with plum vinegar and has an assertive flavor that pairs well with hearty yakisoba noodles, takoyaki, okonomiyaki, and curried fried rice. Pickled ginger will keep well in the fridge for several months. Ground ginger lends deep, pungent notes to treats like marinitos, a Mexican sweet cookie that recalls gingerbread. Excellent ground ginger, like spice and porter, burlap and barrels, buffalo ginger, has a sensational aroma, deep heat, and a slightly sweet finish. Can you substitute ground for fresh ginger? Not really. Adding it to a stir fry, for example, won't yield the same results as fresh ginger. But for a casual marinade or a pot of beans, go ahead. Though proceed with caution, ground ginger packs a punch. And candied or crystallized ginger imparts hot, sweet, chewy pleasure to many treats. Candied sliced ginger tends to be less fibrous than candied chunks. Candied ginger keeps for years if stored in an airtight container. And that was The Joys of Ginger by Andrea Nguyen from the April issue of Food and Wine magazine. And also in this issue, Lucy Simon suggests drink your ginger. Ginger plays well with a range of spirits from dark rum to vodka to whiskey, bringing depth, freshness, and bite. There are a few ways to incorporate ginger into drinks. Add spicy ginger beer, muddle fresh ginger, make a ginger simple syrup, or in the case of the spicy whisker ginger, do all of the above. Give a classic Arnold Palmer a gingery bite by combining 1/2 cup of iced black tea, 1/4 cup of iced ginger tea, 1/4 cup of lemonade, and 1 tablespoon of ginger simple syrup. And that was Drink Your Ginger by Lucy Simon from the April issue of Food and Wine magazine. Thank you for listening today. I'm Julie Haynes of Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.com. Bon appetit.